Greetings, everyone. It's time for Native Son, bringing you news of Indian country on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Your reader is Bethany Williams. The first story I have for you today was published on the 21st of February, 2025, and was written by Levi Reichert of Native News Online. Legislation reintroduced essential veterinary services in rural tribal communities. Studies show that Native children have the highest rate of dog bite injuries in the nation, and the highest rate of dog bite hospitalizations occur in rural Alaska and the Navajo Nation. To combat this problem that occurs in rural tribal communities, U.S. Senators Lisa Murkowski, a Republican of Alaska, and Martin Heinrich, a Democrat of New Mexico, introduced S-620, the Veterinary Services to Improve Public Health in Rural Communities Act. Joining in co-sponsoring the legislation are Senator Brian Schatz, Democrat of Hawaii, Vice Chairman of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs, and Senator Gary Peters, a Democrat of Michigan. The bill was first introduced in the previous Congress in June 2024 by Senator Lisa Murkowski. It seeks to authorize the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and Indian Health Services to provide veterinary services to Indian tribes and tribal organizations. These services, including spaying and neutering of domestic animals, aim to prevent and control severe, life-threatening zoonotic diseases, infections that spread between animals and people in rural tribal communities. The overpopulation of stray and abandoned dogs in Indian country is a significant public health and safety issue, Chairman Murkowski said. My colleagues have been shocked to learn more than 250,000 reservation dogs, as they're often called, roam the Navajo Nation alone. And according to IHS data, an average of 4,800 tribal members are hospitalized or receive outpatient care from dog bites each year. Some studies indicate that tribal areas experience a death rate from dog attacks that is 35 times higher than the rest of the nation. Even a non-fatal dog bite can transmit rabies, parasites, and other zoonotic diseases to humans and unvaccinated animals, leading to serious emotional, economic, and public health costs. I reintroduced this bill because Native children experience the highest rates of hospitalization from dog attacks than any other group in the nation, and we have an opportunity to change that. I thank my colleagues, Senator Heinrich, Schatz, and Peters, and the many advocates who recognize the importance of this legislation. Communities across Indian country are at a higher risk of exposure to dangerous diseases that spread between animals and people, including rabies, said Vice Chairman Schatz. This bill will allow the Indian Health Service to provide critical veterinary services that lower the risk of outbreaks and improve public health. Rabies outbreaks in animals are becoming more frequent across America, and Michigan's rural and tribal communities often lack readily available access to the veterinary care that can keep themselves and their animals protected, said Senator Peters. This bill would help provide important prevention services in some of the communities that need them most. The legislation has gained the support of Navajo President Boo Nigrin. The Navajo Nation strongly supports this legislation, which would provide critical resources to address veterinary care shortages in tribal communities. This bill would assist the nation in reducing rabies-related incidents stemming from dog bites and improving overall animal health, which directly impacts public safety and community well-being. We appreciate Senator Murkowski's leadership in reintroducing this bill and recognizing the urgent need for veterinary services in rural and tribal areas, Nigrin said. The bill does the following. It amends the Indian Health Care Improvement Act to authorize IHS to provide veterinary services in areas where zoonotic diseases are endemic and the risk of transmission is elevated due to uncontrolled dog populations, and enables tribes to include these services in their 638 self-governance compacts with IHS. It provides IHS with the ability to assign or deploy veterinary officers from the U.S. Public Health Service Commissioned Corps to IHS service areas. It requires coordination between IHS, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the Department of Agriculture. And it mandates biennial congressional reporting on program outcomes. It directs the USDA to study wildlife oral rabies vaccine delivery in Arctic regions, and it designates IHS as a coordinator in the National One Health Framework. A copy of the bill and also a summary are available at www.indian.senate.gov. That was legislation reintroduced, Essential Veterinary Services in Rural Tribal Communities. In similar news, also from Native News Online, Masto and Mullen introduced bill aimed at hiring and retention at the Indian Health Service by Neely Bardwell and published on the 19th of February. Today, Senators Catherine Cortez Masto, a Democrat of Nevada, and Mark Wayne Mullen, a Republican of Oklahoma, reintroduced the IHS Workforce Parity Act to make it easier for Indian Health Services to recruit and retain medical workers. The reintroduced bill comes on the heels of a wave of federal layoffs aimed at the IHS. While the layoffs were rescinded, the move sent panic through Indian country among tribes and Native health organizations. It comes a week after the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs held an oversight hearing during which William Smith, chairperson of the Valdez Native Tribe and chairperson of the National Indian Health Board, attested to the critical needs of health care in Indian country. The bipartisan legislation was initially introduced during that last Congress, where it passed the Senate unanimously, but did not make it to voting in the House of Representatives. The IHS Workforce Parity Act would allow providers working part-time to access IHS scholarship and loan repayment programs, making it easier for doctors to stay working at IHS clinics. Historically, IHS, which provides health care to more than 2.5 million American Indians and Alaska Natives, has a 25-30% staff vacancy rate. The severe shortage of IHS healthcare providers poses a threat to the quality of care that Nevadans in tribal communities receive. That's unacceptable, Senator Cortez Masto said in a statement. It's time for Congress to come together to pass my common sense bipartisan legislation and provide real solutions for Indian country. Republican Senator Mullen said in a statement he's confident the legislation will address the current barriers IHS faces when it comes to recruiting and retaining healthcare professionals. Rural healthcare providers like IHS have unique staffing needs, and our bill offers a flexible, cost-effective solution to ensure IHS maintains a competitive edge when considering new recruits. In strengthening the workforce, IHS can ensure a proper quality of care to their patients and improve patient outcomes, Mullen said. That was Masto and Mullen introduced bill aimed at hiring and retention at IHS. Two-Spirit Powwow Empowers Community Amid Growing Anti-Trans Legislation by Brandilyn Clark of Cronkite News, published on the 24th of February, 2025. The Arizona Two-Spirit Powwow returned to Phoenix on Saturday to spotlight Indigenous LGBTQ+ and Two-Spirit people for a day of cultural celebration and community. Hosted at South Mountain Community College, the event welcomed dancers, drum groups, and attendees from across the region. More than just a traditional gathering, the powwow allowed Two-Spirit individuals to celebrate their identities and honor their place in Indigenous culture. This powwow is a perfect example of a safe space for people to come and dance in whatever category they want to dance in, dress in the way they feel good about themselves, love who they want to love, and they are safe there. This tells the community, we're here for you, Sheila Lopez said. Lopez is the founder of Arizona's first Two-Spirit Powwow and the first native chapter of PFLAG, which bills itself as the country's largest advocacy organization that supports LGBTQ+ individuals and their families. President Donald Trump's recent executive actions have left transgender and two-spirit communities uncertain about their rights and recognition going forward. It's super important right now with the administration, what they're doing, to pretty much wipe away trans people. It's super critical right now for us to continue to show up in the community, to say we're here, we're not going anywhere, and you can't erase us, period, Lopez said. The term two-spirit describes individuals who embody masculine and feminine qualities. Unlike the concept of being transgender, two-spirit is not solely about gender identity. It encompasses spiritual, social, and ceremonial roles that differ by tribe. While some two-spirit individuals may also identify as trans, the term itself reflects a broader understanding of gender and community responsibilities within Indigenous cultures. Two-spirit individuals have existed for centuries in Indigenous cultures, but the term itself is modern. It was proposed in 1990 at a gathering of Native LGBTQ+ people. Though two-spirit is now widely recognized, it doesn't fully capture the different ways gender was understood in Indigenous communities long before the term was created. For many Indigenous people who can be described as two-spirit, that isn't their primary identity. River Webb, a member of the Nez Perce and Meskwaki tribal nations, said she first identifies with the term used in her native language, which carries cultural and spiritual meanings tied to specific roles and responsibilities within her tribe. Before I would identify as two-spirit, I identify as a Yaikiewa, which is our word for it, because it's just more accurate to who we are. The term two-spirits is contemporary, but Ayeigewa, spelled E-Y-E-I-G-E-W-A, is a word that has existed for thousands of years, so I prefer to call myself that first, Webb said. It's someone who's a woman, but it's not just any woman. It's a woman who's given a special medicine, who has changed, who is chosen. Webb emphasized the power of powwows as a place for connection, particularly for individuals who have been pushed aside. This is the kind of space for people from all different tribes who have faced ostracization, who have felt like they're not allowed to be in the dance circle. And that's really beautiful because that doesn't exist in every tribe, Webb said. When I first stepped out as a woman, I'm lucky I got to step into my tribe's powwow grounds. But I know people who are told no. For Fentress LeBeau from Cheyenne River, South Dakota, the ostracism that many face only fuels his determination to stand out and set an example for younger Indigenous people. I just try to hit all those small reservations, like the regular powwows, just because I'm showing there are two-spirit and showing the younger ones that are scared or feel like they don't have that support, they can go out and do these things, LeBeau said. Even back home, there's still discrimination against me, and I've lived there for 10 to 15 years, he said. Having these two-spirit powwows gives an outlet. It may be a little bit more colorful, but we're all doing the same thing. The first two-spirit powwow was held in 2012 by the Bay Area American Indian Two-Spirit Organization, according to Forbes. Since then, these gatherings have spread nationwide. The Arizona Two-Spirit Powwow, founded in 2019, is overseen by Gerard Begay, the South Mountain Community College American Indian Student Center coordinator who also identifies as Two-Spirit. There are other people coming from other states, coming through and visiting us and being part of the celebration. So yes, it's grown tremendously, Begay said. For me, it's important to share that part of our culture, because a lot of times we're never brought up, or it's hidden away. By doing this, it puts us at a pedestal and puts us in the spotlight, and it allows us to celebrate our LGBT community at a different level, he said. That was Arizona Two-Spirit Powwow Empowers Community. They should call it an M-Powwow. No, they shouldn't. And I'm going to pause here for a minute to remind you that you're listening to Native Sun on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Sun Sounds of Arizona has been providing the disabled with audio access to print information for over 40 years. Learn how you can support us at our website, sunsounds.org, where you can also listen to our live streams or find individual episodes on demand. This next article from ICT is part of ICT's recognition of Black History Month. It's by Shirley Sneave and is titled, Hall of Fame Cowboy Uses Multicultural Heritage to Bring People Together. Published on the 24th of February, 2025. Lynn, known as Smokey Hart, was the only African-American Native person growing up in Chancellor, South Dakota, about a half hour west of Sioux Falls near the Minnesota border. In fact, he hadn't seen another Black person until he journeyed to Washington, D.C. area as a 10-year-old. That was the first time I'd ever seen Black people, he said. I started counting Black people going up Pennsylvania Avenue, and I got to about 200 and I quit. I call myself a flake of pepper and a salt shaker. His multicultural heritage has followed him throughout his life. He works as a ranch hand and became well known on the rodeo circuit, riding bulls with the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association, the All Indian Rodeo Cowboys Association, and the Bill Pickett Invitational Rodeo. He became a rodeo clown after getting injured. Now 65, he's been inducted into the Hall of Fame for the National Multicultural Western Heritage Museum, formerly the National Cowboys of Color Museum, in Fort Worth, Texas, in 2021, and he designed the national logo for the Native American Women Warrior Organization. He's an activist for human and civil rights in South Dakota, where he helped win designations of two legal holidays in the state, the second Monday in October as Native Americans Day and the third Monday in January as Martin Luther King Jr. Day. I've tried to tell everybody, education creates reconciliation, because if I don't know about you and you don't know about me, how are we ever going to get along in the first place? He told ICT. We need to come together once again, not apart, and sit down and listen to each other. Hart's mother was a citizen of the Yankton Nakota Nation, and she met his African-American father at Ellsworth Air Force Base in Rapid City, South Dakota. He was born December 11th, 1960, but was taken into foster care as an infant by a German woman in South Dakota. His foster family didn't make much of his race in the small farming community where he lived for his first decade. He fit in just like everybody else. When his foster mother died, he was placed in another foster home in Maryland, then adopted by the Hart family in Washington, D.C. They soon moved to Watertown, South Dakota. He said he felt like a chameleon, since he got along well with everybody. His outgoing personality set him up for an interesting journey to his current home, operating a ranch on the Flandreau Santee Dakota Reservation just north of Sioux Falls, South Dakota. He married Helen Gilbert, an enrolled member of that tribe 16 years ago. His rodeo career had its beginnings in a bar in Yuma, Arizona. I was in the Marine Corps stationed in Yuma, Arizona, and I went to a bar one night, and there are these cowboys standing in the corner, Hart said. He found out they were bull riders. At this point in the article, there's a photograph of Lynn Hart in the foreground sitting next to a horse in a green pasture. And in the midground, there's a couple of other horses and some cows and trees and mountains in the background. I said, anybody can do that, he said. Being raised in Chancellor, there was this old bull I used to ride all the time. His name was Ferdinand. They used to put me on this bull, and I'd ride around as a little kid when I was 6 or 7. The next thing I knew, they got me a bull rope and hat and all this stuff and stuck me on my first bull down in Tucson, Arizona, and I rode him. The bull stepped on me and broke my ribs and punctured my lung, he said. They taught me how to ride it, but they never taught me how to get off. He went on the bull riding circuit and played York during the Lewis and Clark Expedition Bicentennial. I loved that journey because it was a reconciliation between Lewis and Clark and the American Indians, all the tribes that they met, Hart said. He also toured with the All Black Rodeo Association, the Bill Pickett Invitational Rodeo, and named for the groundbreaking bulldogger. Hart took his first steps into politics in 1990. Then South Dakota Governor George Mickelson declared 1990 as the Year of Reconciliation, following the state's centennial in 1989. But Hart worked to take the state one level higher in its reconciliation efforts. He worked with State Representative Pat Kane, who introduced a bill to recognize the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. Kane's bill didn't seem to have a chance, yet Hart went to the legislature to talk about it. Hart sat at a table in the old version of Room 412 and told a difficult truth to the line of lawmakers and the House State Affairs Committee. Some cowboys on the rodeo circuit, he said, wouldn't come to South Dakota because they considered the state racist. That's when some Republicans came up with a different idea. They introduced HB 1308, with the prime sponsor being House Republican leader State Representative Jerry Lammers of Madison. His bill designated the second Monday of October as Native Americans Day and established the third Monday of January as Martin Luther King Jr. Day, both official holidays for South Dakota. The bill passed. King's widow later honored Hart for his courage. On January 13, 1992, Coretta Scott King, music legend Stevie Wonder, and then FBI Director William Sessions presented Hart with the National Making of a King Holiday Award in Washington, D.C. Pete Catches Sr., an Oglala Lakota medicine man, also received the award. A lot of people don't know his story, that he and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. were best friends, Hart said. Pete adopted him as a brother. Hart continues to be involved in politics at the tribal, state, and national levels, and he looks to the words and actions of Martin Luther King Jr. for inspiration. I want to be helpful, he said. Dr. King spoke so eloquently about being one. You're rich, you're poor, no. Let's just help each other out. And then that's where we're at right now. That's what I want to do, is help. And that was Hall of Fame cowboy Lynn Smokey Hart. This next article is how a tribe won a legal battle against the Federal Bureau of Indian Education and still lost. It was published on the 22nd of February, 2025, and it was a collaboration between the Hechinger Report, which is a nonprofit newsroom that reports on education, and ICT, written by Neil Morton. Dateline Supai, Arizona. Cambria Siuja always felt like the smartest kid in Supai. Raised by educators in the tribal village at the base of the Grand Canyon, she started kindergarten a little ahead of her peers. Her teachers at Havasupai Elementary School often asked Siuja to tutor younger students and sometimes even let her run their classrooms. She graduated valedictorian of her class. But when she left the K-8 school at the top of her grade, Siuja stopped feeling so smart. I didn't know math or basic formulas, she said. Typing and tech, non-existent. Siuja, now 22, wiped tears from her face as she sat alongside her mother and grandmother, the educators of the family, one afternoon last year, in the Havasupai Tribal Council chambers. The trio wept as they recalled Siuja's move as a teenager to a private boarding school 100 miles away in Sedona, Arizona, which she'd chosen to attend because the federal agency that runs Havasupai Elementary, the only school in her village, provides no options for high school. Once there, however, Siuja discovered how little she'd learned at the Supai school. She had only superficial familiarity with state and U.S. history and knew none of the literature her peers had read years earlier. She was the only freshman who'd never taken pre-algebra. Last year, 8 years after Siuja graduated, the K-8 school still did not offer pre-algebra, a course that most U.S. public school students take in 7th or 8th grade, if not earlier. It had no textbooks for math, science, or social studies. The school's remoteness On a 518-acre reservation, the government forcibly relocated the Havasupai people to more than 150 years ago, makes it a challenge to staff, and chronic turnover required the few educators who remained to teach multiple grades at once. Only 3% of students test proficiently in either English, language arts, or math. I know they struggle a lot because of how few resources we have down here, said Siuja of Supai, which visitors must reach either by 8-mile hike or helicopter. But what are they teaching here? In 2017, 6 Havasupai families sued the federal government, alleging the Bureau of Indian Education, which operates Havasupai Elementary and is housed within the Interior Department, deprived their children of their federal right to an education. The tribe, in a brief supporting the lawsuit, argued the Bureau had allowed Havasupai Elementary to become the worst school in a deplorable BIE system, and that court intervention was required to protect students from the agency. The families eventually secured 2 historic settlements that fueled hopes across Indian country that true reform might finally improve outcomes both in Supai and perhaps also at BIE schools throughout the U.S. So far, the settlements have brought new staff to Supai, and the BIE had to reconstitute the school board. Teachers must now use lesson plans, and they finally have a curriculum to use in English, science, and math classes. A new principal pledged to stay longer than a school year. We now have some teachers and some repairs to the building that are being done, said Dinaline Kaska, a mother to 3 former students and a new school board member. It's been a long time just to get to this point. The legal wins followed an effort to reform the BIE as a whole. In 2014, federal officials unveiled a sweeping plan to overhaul the beleaguered bureau, which had long struggled to deliver better student outcomes, with anemic funding. But in the past decade, after a nearly doubling of its budget, the BIE has finally started to make some progress. This article is quite long, so I have to cut it off here and read the rest of it to you next time. You've been listening, for now, to Native Sun, the show for Indigenous issues on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your reader, Bethany Williams. Music is Indomitable by DJ Shub.